We often talk about logic like it's this invincible superpower.
Right, like it can do anything.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you just have enough data, and you think clearly enough, you
Yeah.
can build a ladder of proof that reaches all the way up to the ultimate answers.
The really big questions.
Yeah. You can prove the soul exists.
Yeah.
You can prove the universe had a beginning. You can logically prove God is out there.
It's basically the old Enlightenment dream, you know, the idea that pure reason is this universal solvent.
Solves it.
Yeah, like it can dissolve any mystery if you just apply it vigorously enough.
But then you hit the late 18th century and Immanuel Kant walks into the room.
Oh, yeah. He definitely walked in and flipped the
He
tables.
did. Because he doesn't just disagree with the answers people are finding. He looks at the questions themselves, looks at the tool of pure reason they were using, and basically says, you're trying to use a telescope to hear a symphony.
That's a great way to put it.
It's not just that you're wrong. It's that you are structurally incapable of being right.
Which is, that is the pivotal moment in modern philosophy.
Completely.
Kant acts as the judge in what he calls the court of reason, and he ends up throwing the biggest cases out of court for lack of jurisdiction.
So today we are taking a deep dive into that courtroom drama. We're looking at Kant's critique of pure reason, specifically the section called the Transcendental Dialectic.
A very intimidating title.
It is. But we're basing this on a lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes, and he does this fantastic job of mapping out exactly how Kant dismantled the traditional arguments for the soul, the world, and God.
And dismantled really is the right word here, but, and this is a huge caveat, he didn't do it to destroy belief.
Right.
He actually did it to save belief.
And that is the twist we are building toward today. But before we get there, we have to establish the ground rules. If you've been following our philosophy deep dives, you probably already know Kant's big distinction.
Phenomena versus noumena.
Exactly.
Right. It's the foundation of everything else he talks about. Kant argues that our mind is not just a passive mirror reflecting reality out there.
It's not just taking in a video feed.
No, it's an active factory. It processes raw data through these built-in filters, space, time, causality.
So we only ever know the phenomena.
Right. Things as they appear to us after being processed by our mental factory.
Which means we never actually know the noumena, the things in themselves.
Exactly. Reality, unassigned, unfiltered, raw reality. We can't access it.
And so the transcendental dialectic from the lecture is what happens when human reason gets arrogant.
Oh, very arrogant.
It happens when we try to use those mental filters, which work totally fine for things like apples and planets.
Right. Everyday objects.
And we try to use them to talk about things that aren't in space or time at all, things like the soul or God.
Dr. Holmes calls this the logic of illusion.
The logic of illusion. I like that.
It's not that we're making simple math errors, you know, is that we are naturally programmed to ask questions that we just aren't equipped to answer.
So let's look at the first defendant Kant calls to the stand, the soul, or what the philosophers back then called rational psychology.
The central question here is really, is the soul a substance?
Right. Is it a permanent, indestructible thing that lives inside us?
And usually the argument for this starts with Descartes.
Cogito ergo sum.
Exactly. I think, therefore I am. It feels totally undeniable. If I'm thinking, there has to be a me doing the thinking.
Kant actually agrees with that part, right? He agrees with that, I think.
He does. He agrees that there is an activity of thinking happening. But he says Descartes made this massive illegal leap.
How so?
He jumped from thinking is happening to I am a thinking substance.
A res cogitans.
Yes, a thinking thing.
Wait, help me distinguish those two, because if I'm thinking, aren't I automatically a thing that thinks?
Not in the metaphysical way you mean it. Think about the word substance.
Okay.
It's a category we use for the physical world, like a rock or a chair.
Something you can knock on.
Right. A substance is permanent, it occupies space, it holds together through time. Kant says we have absolutely no right to apply their heavy physical category to the I.
So by doing that, I'm basically treating my consciousness like it's a phantom brick.
That is a brilliant way to put it. Yeah, a phantom brick. Think of it like an eye trying to see itself.
Okay, an eyeball.
Right. The eye can see the whole world. It sees trees, mountains, light. But the eye can never actually see the I that is doing the seeing.
I mean, it can see a reflection in a mirror.
Sure, but it can never see itself directly as an object in its own field of vision.
That is actually a little vertigo-inducing if you think about it.
It is.
The eye is the camera, so it can never literally be in the
Yes,
photograph.
exactly. The I is the subject, never the object. But rational psychology tries to force the subject to become an object, a soul substance.
And Kant has a specific word for this error from the source.
Yeah.
A paralogism.
Yes, paralogism. It's a logical fallacy where we confuse the unity of our thoughts with the unity of a literal thing. We hypostasize it. We treat a concept like a concrete entity.
But why are we so desperate to do that? Why do we need the soul to be a thing so badly?
Identity. And fear.
Fear of what?
Well, if I'm just a stream of thoughts, what guarantees that the me who wakes up tomorrow is the exact same me who goes to sleep tonight?
Oh, I see. I need a container.
You need a substance to hold your identity together. Plus, if the soul isn't a substance, we get terrified that we're just biology, just matter in motion.
The fear of materialism. If I'm not a spiritual substance, I'm just a wet robot.
Exactly. And that fear leads right into the famous mind-body problem.
Right. Because if the mind is a spiritual substance and the body is a physical substance, how do they talk to each other?
How does the ghost push the machine?
Philosophers spent centuries trying to fix this.
They really did. You had Descartes arguing for physical influence.
Through the pineal gland.
Right. Then you had Leibniz with his pre-established harmony, where God basically synchronizes the mind and body like two clocks ticking at the same time.
And occasionalism, too.
Yes, supernatural assistance, where God actively intervenes every time you want to move your arm.
It all sounds so exhausting.
It is. And Kant just comes in and cuts the Gordian knot.
What does he say?
He says it is a pseudo problem.
A pseudo problem, so it's not even a real issue.
Right. You created the problem by falsely labeling the mind as a substance in the first place. If you stop thinking of the mind as a thing, like a body is a thing, the whole problem of how they mechanically interact just evaporates.
But hold on. Calling it a pseudo problem kind of feels like a dodge.
Oh, so?
Because I still have the very real experience of deciding to move my hand and then my hand moves. Even if I'm not a substance, there is an interaction happening.
Tent wouldn't deny your experience.
Okay.
He's just denying that you can explain it using the metaphysics of substances. He's saying, stop looking for the physical gears connecting the ghost and the machine, because a ghost isn't a machine part.
It's like asking for the aerodynamics of a concept.
That's a category error. Exactly.
Okay, I see the distinction. He's closing the door on logically proving the soul is an object.
Yes, firmly closed.
So let's move out from the inner world to the outer world.
Hmm.
The second big question. The universe. The cosmos.
Rational cosmology. This is where we try to wrap our tiny minds around the universe as a whole.
And this is where Dr. Holmes gets into the antinomies.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, this is probably the part of the lecture that genuinely broke my brain.
It does that to people.
An antinomy isn't just a simple mistake. It's a gridlock, right?
It's a total logical paradox. Kant shows that when we try to talk about the absolute limits of the universe, reason basically eats itself.
Eats itself.
Yeah. Because you can logically prove a thesis, but then you can turn around and logically prove its exact opposite, the antithesis.
Using the exact same tool of reason.
Right. Let's look at the first conflict he brings up. Time and space. Does the world have a beginning, or is it infinite?
Okay, let's play this out. I'll take the thesis. I will prove to you the world has a beginning.
I'm listening.
All right. Kant uses this reductio ad absurdum method. So I will assume the opposite of what I want to prove. Let's assume the world has no beginning. That means the past is infinite. But if the past is infinite, that means an infinite amount of time has actually passed to get to this specific moment right now.
And what is the problem with that?
You cannot traverse an infinite series. If I have to count to infinity before I can snap my fingers, I will literally never snap my fingers.
Right.
So if the past is infinite, we could never have arrived at today. But we are here. So the past must be finite. The world must have a beginning.
The logic seems totally sound.
It feels bulletproof.
Now watch it collapse.
Oh, boy.
I'll take the antithesis. The world has no beginning. It's infinite.
Prove it.
I'll assume you are right, and the universe did have a beginning. That implies there was a first moment.
Sure. The Big Bang.
Yeah.
Genesis. Whatever you want to call it.
But what was there before that first moment?
Nothing. Empty time.
Exactly. In a void of purely empty time, every moment is completely identical to every other moment. There's no distinguishing condition. Meaning, why would the universe suddenly pop into existence at Tuesday at 8 a.m. rather than Monday at 7 a.m. if there is absolutely no difference between those moments?
Mm-hmm.
In empty time, nothing can originate. Therefore, a definitive beginning is impossible. The world must be infinite.
Wow. So we're stuck.
We are gridlocked. Both arguments make total logical sense, but they completely contradict each other.
And Holmes mentions he does this for other things too, not just time.
Right. He does it for space. Is the world finite or infinite in size? He does it for matter.
The atom issue.
Yes. Are there simple indivisible parts atoms, or is matter infinitely divisible? You can prove both.
And freedom versus determinism, right?
That is the big one. Is there causality of freedom, or is there only natural determinism? Again, logic proves both are true and both are false.
If logic proves both sides, does that mean logic itself is just broken?
No, it means the premise is broken.
What's the premise?
The mistake, according to Kant, is that we are treating the universe as a thing in itself, an object sitting out there waiting to be measured.
But if the universe isn't a thing out there, what is it?
It's a regulative idea.
Okay, unpack that.
The world as a whole is a construct our mind creates to organize our experiences. But the world itself doesn't have time or space as intrinsic properties.
Because space and time are our mental filters. Transcendental idealism.
Exactly. So when we ask, did the universe have a beginning in time, we are trying to apply a human mental filter to a reality that exists outside of that filter.
Oh, I get it. It's like asking, is the number 7 angry or happy?
That's good.
The question just doesn't apply because numbers don't have emotions.
It's like wearing blue-tinted glasses and arguing endlessly about whether the invisible air itself is blue.
The blueness is in the glasses, not the air.
Right. The time is in us, not the universe in itself. The gridlock happens because we treat a representation like its ultimate reality.
So the conflict just disappears because the question was fundamentally flawed from the start. Okay, so we can't prove the soul exists because it's not a substance. We can't prove the universe has a beginning because time is just a mental construct.
Which leaves the final frontier.
The final boss of metaphysics, God.
Rational theology. This is where Kant takes on the giants. The ontological, cosmological, and teleological arguments.
Holmes points out that for Kant, God is an ideal.
Capital I.
Right. He's the ultimate concept we use to round out and unify all our understanding. But the disaster happens when we try to prove this ideal is a literal fact.
And his most famous takedown here is of the ontological argument.
This is the argument that says you can prove God exists just by analyzing the definition of God.
Right. It goes, God is a perfect being. A perfect being must have all perfections. Existence is a perfection, therefore God exists.
It's very clever verbal gymnastics.
It is, but Kant destroys it with just 5 words.
Existence is not a predicate.
Ooh.
This is the part that I think trips people up the most. Existence is not a predicate. Sounds like grammar school. We really need to unpack this.
Okay, let's do it. A predicate is just a quality or property you assign to a subject. If I say, the coffee is hot, hot is the predicate.
It tells me something about the coffee.
Right. It adds content to the concept.
Like the coffee is hot, bitter, and dark. I'm adding information.
Now imagine I say, the coffee exists. Have I added any new flavor, temperature, or color to the concept of the coffee?
No. I've just said there's a cup physically sitting on the table.
Exactly. Kant uses this famous example of 100 thalers.
Gold coins.
Right. He says, imagine a pile of 100 real gold coins on a table. Now imagine a concept of 100 gold coins in your mind.
Okay.
The concept in your mind has to have every single mathematical quality that the real coins have. If the real coins have a property that the concept lacks, then the concept isn't actually of those coins.
So the concept is perfectly identical to the reality in terms of description.
Yes. So saying it exists adds absolutely zero to the description. Let's use a modern analogy. Imagine you are describing your absolute perfect partner to a friend. You make a list. They are kind, they are intelligent, they are hilarious, they love late 18th century German philosophy.
A very rare breed.
Unbelievably rare. But now you have this perfect concept. If you add one more bullet point to the list and they exist, does that magically drag them out of your imagination and into your living room?
Sadly, no.
Exactly. You cannot define something into existence.
If existence isn't an adjective.
Right. It's not a quality you paint onto a concept. It is the positioning of that thing in reality. So the ontological argument fails completely because it treats existence like a predicate.
And once that argument falls, Holmes says the other arguments fall like dominoes.
They absolutely do. Take the cosmological argument.
That's the one that says everything has a cause. So there must be a first cause.
Right. But to identify that first cause as God, you have to assume that God is a necessary being.
Oh, which secretly smuggles in the ontological argument.
Exactly. It relies on the very thing Kant just disproved. Not to mention, it misuses the category of causation outside of human experience.
And what about the third one, the teleological argument, the whole watchmaker intelligent design idea?
The physico-theological argument, as Kant calls it. He actually has a lot of respect for this one.
Because nature is so orderly.
Yes. But he says, logically, at best, it only proves an architect.
An architect.
Someone who arranged the pre-existing matter. It does not prove a creator who made the matter out of nothing. To get from an architect to a creator, you need the cosmological argument.
Which needs the ontological argument.
Exactly. So since the bottom rung of the ladder is completely broken,
the whole ladder collapses.
It is a total wipeout. By the end of the critique, rational theology is basically in ruins.
Honestly, this sounds incredibly depressing.
Okay.
If you were a believer in Kant's time, reading this must have felt like a massive attack.
Oh, people were terrified. But here is the major shift. This is why Kant is so vital. He didn't burn the house down to leave us out in the cold. He cleared the rubble to build something much stronger.
He has that famous quote, "I have found it necessary to deny knowledge in order to make room for belief."
Just think about what that really means. Let's say you could prove God existed using airtight logic, like a mathematical equation.
Okay.
Would your response to that be faith?
No, it would just be a fact. I mean, I don't have faith in gravity. I just know it works.
Right. And if God were just a proven, undeniable fact, you would have no choice but to obey.
Because the proof is staring me in the face.
You'd basically be a compliant robot. There would be no moral struggle, no active choice to believe despite the darkness or the uncertainty.
So by destroying the logical proof, he actually rescues the meaning of belief. He opens the door for a different kind of certainty.
Yes. Practical certainty, moral certainty. He shifts the entire foundation from pure reason, which is logic, to practical reason, which is ethics.
And this connects to how we live. We use these ideas, God, the soul, as regulative concepts.
Exactly. We live as if they are true. We study the world as if it is a unified whole. We act as if we have a permanent soul.
Holmes distinguishes between doctrinal belief and moral belief here, doesn't he?
He does. Doctrinal belief is believing in a supreme intelligence just because it helps explain the order of nature.
It's useful, but maybe a bit unstable.
Very unstable. Because science might eventually explain that order without needing God. But moral belief, that is the stronger path.
How did that work?
It starts with the conscience. Kant says, look inside yourself. You feel a command. A moral law. Do the right thing simply because it is right.
We all feel that way.
It's undeniable. And there is a philosophical principle here. Ought implies can.
Meaning, if I ought to do something, it must actually be possible for me to do it.
Right. Which means you cannot just be a meat robot driven by biology. You have to be free.
Postulate number one, freedom.
Yes. We can't prove we are logically free. Remember the antinomies gridlock? But we must assume we are free to make any sense of our morality.
What are the other postulates we have to assume?
Well, the moral law demands absolute perfection, but we obviously can't achieve perfection in a short, finite lifetime.
Definitely not.
So to make sense of that moral demand, we have to assume that the soul continues. Immortality.
And the final postulate.
God. The moral law tells us that virtue should lead to happiness. Good people should prosper.
But in the real world, terrible people get rich.
Yeah.
And good people suffer all the time.
It's totally irrational. It's unfair. So for the moral universe to actually make sense, we must assume there is a supreme administrator.
God, God.
Who eventually, ultimately, balances the scales.
Wow, that is actually really beautiful. It's not, I can prove God exists because of this rigid syllogism.
Right.
It's, I must believe God exists because otherwise my deep commitment to being a good person is totally absurd.
It completely validates the human experience. It says your moral compass is actually a better guide to ultimate reality than your logical calculator.
We live as if, and that as if isn't a weakness.
Not at all. It's a source of immense power. It changes belief from just passively accepting facts into an active, courageous moral choice. You are choosing to live in a universe that has meaning.
So Kant restricts reason just to keep her from talking nonsense about things he can't see. But then he elevates morality to be our actual connection to the divine.
That is his true legacy. He saves us from the arrogance of thinking we can know everything. And he simultaneously saves us from the despair of thinking nothing matters.
It brings up a really provocative final thought for me.
What's that?
We spend so much time today looking for evidence. We want data for absolutely everything.
We do.
But Kant suggests that the most important things in life, who we are, why we're here, how we should treat each other, those aren't things you're ever going to find in a data set.
No, they aren't.
They are things you have to postulate. You have to build them yourself out of sheer moral necessity.
It puts the responsibility entirely back on us. The universe isn't going to just hand you the answers on a cheat sheet. You have to live the answers.
That is a lot to chew on. So as you go about your day, think about that eye analogy. You are the looker, not the object. And think about your own beliefs. Are they just sitting around waiting for logical proof, or are they waiting for you to actively commit to them?
Sometimes taking that leap of faith really is the most rational step you can take.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
We'll see you next time.